England may have thought the threat from Napoleon was over. Collingwood knew that Bonaparte had lost temporary control of the sea and that the immediate threat of invasion was over, but that he was still powerful enough to rebuild his fleets and still dominated the continental scene. Napoleon had crushed an Austro-Russian alliance at the Battle of Austerlitz in December 1805. The Navy's guard could not be dropped for an instant. While the overall strategy remained, to dominate the major trade routes and provoke the French fleet into another set-piece battle, the detail was changed. Smaller squadrons were dispatched to harry ports and harbours and close the lid on illicit trade, and Collingwood began a series of subtle diplomatic manoeuvres that eventually won him high praise from his government. Elsewhere there was good news in actions by Duckworth in the Caribbean and Hood off Rochefort, engaging and defeating remnants of the Cadiz and Brest squadrons. For the time being, the Mediterranean belonged wholly to Collingwood, who, isolated from his higher command structure, had to improvise his own strategy to deal with a political and military situation that was in constant flux. It was during this time that his ship, after Royal Sovereign returned to England he hoisted his flag in Queen and then a ship called Ocean, did not even anchor for more than a year. He wrote proudly that in all that time there had been no more than 6 men in the sick bay. He believed in a clean, dry ship, and in feeding his crews with fresh food wherever possible. While Collingwood watched Cadiz and Gibraltar, Napoleon was opening a diplomatic front much further to the east that threatened the admiral's Mediterranean strategy. France was pressurizing the Turks to close the Black Sea to the Russian fleet. Collingwood sent a squadron under Vice Admiral Duckworth to the Dardanelles, where he and the diplomatics vacillated and failed to seize the strategic or political initiative, allowing the Turks to fortify the straits against attack from both north and south. There was a disastrous military expedition to Egypt, which ended in failure and ignominy. It seemed that the news was bad everywhere. French armies again took Naples, and with the defeat of Austria they also held the crucial ports of Venice and Trieste in the Adriatic. By 1807, having made peace with the Russians at Tilsit, France had annexed the Ionian islands off Greece and was threatening an invasion of Sicily. The navy had a single base, Malta, in more than 2,000 miles of sea between Gibraltar and Constantinople, and from here Collingwood had to rely on small squadrons to protect vital trade against not only French but also Algerian and other pirates. Like Nelson before him, he was desperately short of frigates. It was now that the strategic role of Sicily began to dominate his thoughts. The kingdom of the two Sicilies, Naples and the extreme south of Italy together with Sicily, was a rump of the Bourbon monarchies that had been overthrown by revolution. Its rulers, King Ferdinand and Queen Maria Carolina, sister of the decapitated Marie Antoinette, had been briefly evacuated by Nelson in 1799 from Naples to Palermo as Napoleon's armies overran Italy. Again in 1806 the French occupied Naples, and this time the king and queen fled permanently to Sicily, whilst constantly intriguing with the French to recover their lost possessions. Their choice was between the devil, Napoleon Bonaparte, and the Deep Blue Sea, a British government that they believed had designs to keep Sicily as a British possession. Their court was a centre for political intrigue as well as a famously indulgent social scene. Nelson had courted the Bourbon monarchy. Collingwood avoided them like the plague. As early as the spring of 1806 he was corresponding with the king, though. In answer to Ferdinand's pleas to protect the island, Collingwood replied that the best thing he could do to protect Sicily was to prevent the French fleet from getting out of Toulon and Cadiz, which was exactly what he was doing. He assured the king of his continued vigilance and his desire to protect their majesties to the utmost of his powers. The correspondence shows that they communicated as virtual equals. Meanwhile, General Craig had been sent to Sicily with an 8,000-strong army to watch the Straits of Messina between Sicily and the mainland, an obvious focus for attack. Like the English Channel, it only needed to be held for a day or so to ensure the safe passage of an invading force. But unlike the Channel, it was just 2 miles wide. So now, deciding to allow the French out of Toulon so that he could track them and bring them to battle, Collingwood focused his thoughts on Sicily, the Adriatic, and the eastern Mediterranean, where relations with the Russians and Turks were in a constant flux. By the end of 1807 he had 3 squadrons posted around Sicily, at Messina, at Palermo, and himself at Syracuse. Collingwood's first visit to Syracuse in December 1807 was cut short by word that the French fleet was at sea. He chased them, and like Nelson in 1798, he missed them. But he was back there in January 1808, and again in March. Collingwood did briefly visit Palermo in 1808. He wrote home that he was annoyed with himself for having left in such a hurry that his shirts were still there being laundered. It was almost another whole year, though, before Collingwood, distracted by events elsewhere, finally met the King and Queen. "The King," he wrote, "is a good-humoured man, free and affable in his manners, and had he not unhappily been born to be a king, would have been a respectable country gentleman. Matters of state weary him, and I understand he does not attend much to them. His country amusements of hunting and shooting occupy him. On the other hand, the Queen is the great politician, and is continually engaged in intrigues for the recovery of their lost kingdom of Naples." Such was Collingwood's control of the situation that the French admiral, Gontaume, under the most severe pressure from his master, was never able to make a single landing in Sicily. Not for the first time, Collingwood's achievements in preventing a British possession from falling into French hands had won him discreet but heartfelt praise from the British government, whose greatest asset he proved during his last years in the Mediterranean. Once again, his strategic cunning, his diplomatic skill, and his deep and thorough knowledge of the sea and his fleet's capabilities had confounded Bonaparte. It was this period, when he was literally being worn out by worry and constant vigilance, that his obituarist was referring to later, when he wrote, "The writer has seen him upon deck without his hat, and his grey hair floating to the wind, whilst torrents of rain poured down through the shrouds, and his eye like an eagle's on the watch." All through this time, Collingwood had had no leave. He'd not set eyes on England since 1803, and his knowledge of events at home was confined to correspondence and a very occasional newspaper or naval gazette. He was worried, too, by some of the things he heard. He'd inherited a coal mine at Churton near North Shields, and had to try to manage it at a distance of several thousand miles. He corresponded with the Duke of Northumberland about rights of access for his wagonways, and interestingly, as equals, they discussed the progress of the war. But now that Sarah was a reasonably wealthy woman and a member of society, Collingwood found that she and her father were spending considerably more money than his navy pay brought in, well beyond his means, in fact. He was concerned, too, that his daughter's education was being sacrificed to an endless round of social gatherings and frivolous pursuits. There was little he could do to influence events at home, so irregular was his contact. One person he still thought about often was his old flame, Mary Moutray. Even now, more than 20 years after they'd met in Antigua, he was writing to her, and his letters were as warm as ever. "My dear friend," he wrote, "I wish you had one of those fairy telescopes that can look into the hearts and souls of people 1,000 leagues off. Then you might see how much you possess my mind, and how sincere an interest I take in whatever relates to your happiness and that of your dear Kate." Collingwood's health was failing. He was working himself to death. Between May of 1807 and June 1808, he wrote letters, dispatches, and orders from the following locations: Gibraltar, Sardinia, Sicily, Malta, and Imbro. In August of 1807 he was in the Dardanelles sorting out the mess left by Duckworth, then to Tenedos and Matapan, then Syracuse, then Palermo, Maritimo, and Corfu, where he later succeeded brilliantly in kicking the French out. In January 1808 he was back at Syracuse, then in April he was at Menorca, as relations between France and Spain deteriorated, and the Spanish began to look cautiously for aid to the British. Then he sailed back to Sicily, then to Cadiz again, and for a while after that he was back on his old stamping ground, the Toulon blockade. It was a staggering tour of duty. One can only be amazed that it didn't kill him before it did.